Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Ask Americans today what our greatest environmental threat is, and many will answer climate change. But 30 or 40 years ago, the big concern was overpopulation. In the 1960s and 70s, this fear that the world would soon run out of water, food, land was everywhere. Television, popular books, magazine covers, Republicans and Democrats alike shared this concern. But then a backlash developed. Overpopulation became a taboo topic for many, and environmental politics shifted from relatively bipartisan to the right-left splits we see today. All in all, it's an emotionally charged history, but tackled recently by NHPR's Outside In team. And today in The Exchange, we dive into that work. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Sam Evans Brown is with us, host of Outside In, our podcast about the natural world and how we use it. And Sam, thank you so much.
I'm so glad to be here.
So some call discussing overpopulation the third rail of environmental politics. You're just not supposed to touch it, too touchy. But then it comes up just recently in a superhero movie, Marvel Comics, Avengers Infinity War. Here's super duper bad guy, Thanos. Let's hear.
It's a simple calculus. This universe is finite. Its resource is finite. If life is left unchecked, life will cease to exist. It needs correction.
You don't know that!
I'm the only one who knows that. At least I'm the only one with the will to act on it.
So there you go. Thanos, basically, as you say in this double episode, Sam, playing the role of a 1960s or 70s environmentalist. How come?
Well, I think it's sort of, this is the thesis of the two episodes that we put out on this issue, is that this particular subject is one that started out as a widespread concern, and then critiques began to develop sort of in the halls of academia, but also in political spheres. And as those critiques percolated throughout the culture, it's an idea that began to drop off the radar and now has fallen to the point where you'll literally only hear it out the mouth of the worst villain in the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe. And so it's one that has become literally radioactive.
Well, and you mentioned in the episode, though, that so Thanos puts this idea out there that humanity needs to be curtailed, so to speak, to save itself. What was the public response to this idea that this Marvel Comics villain put out there? You say in the episode that some people said, yeah, Thanos has the right idea.
Well, it's very funny. Online on Reddit, if anyone knows the website Reddit, which is a place where a lot of sort of toxic internet culture happily thrives, there was a group that popped up called Thanos Was Right, or Thanos Did Nothing Wrong was what it was called. And, over 400,000 people joined it. And it was somewhat satirical, I think. And there was actually a point at which, because the premise of the Marvel movie is that he snaps his finger and half of all of life in the universe ceases to exist. And so halfway through, this Reddit group banned half of its users randomly. But just to illustrate the point, there are a lot of people out there who still think, well, overpopulation is something that we should be worried about, is something that we should be talking about. And we did this experiment ourselves where we stood out in front of the local bookshop here in Concord, and I asked people, what is the greatest environmental threat to the world today? Most people said climate change, but then I followed up and said, what if I said you aren't allowed to say climate change? And quite a few people in just a half an hour standing on the street came up with overpopulation.
Well, I think one of Dan Brown's books, I think it was Inferno, also has a sort of a mad scientist bad guy who is concerned about planetary health and overpopulation, and I won't give it away, but so there's another person.
Well, and I think the fact that in our fictional universes that it's really only bad guys who are talking about this really speaks to the history that we're going to dig into in the next hour. And we, you know, I won't give too much away because we'll sort of get there as we go. But the short version is basically that this concern has been taken to very problematic places.
So let's dig into it because it is really interesting. And I want to go back even before the 60s and 70s. And by the way, I grew up in the 70s. I remember some of the messaging. I remember seeing a button on one of my parents' dressers that said, stop at 2.
Right.
And I think I told you yesterday, I'm the third child. So I always kind of looked at that and went, what does this say about me?
But they held on to the button.
But, you know, there's a history of this way before the 60s and 70s that I'm sure a lot of our listeners remember, all the way going back to a guy named Malthus. Now, I remember learning about this in school, but you're going to have to refresh our memories on sort of who he was, when he was talking, and what his basic point was.
Yeah, so Thomas Malthus was a British economist and clergyman who was alive around the turn of the 1800s, so late 1700s, early 1800s is when he was writing. He's actually not the first person to write about overpopulation. In fact, overpopulation has been a concern basically going back as far as we have text. Malthus was really just the first one who is the latest thinker to have written about it, to have achieved sort of a broad readership. And so he was read by the founding fathers of America. Benjamin Franklin was a Malthusian acolyte. And his ideas are the ones that have sort of percolated up through into the birth of the modern environmental movement. But he was actually mostly concerned about poor people in the UK, in Britain, concerned that there were sort of too many of them, and that if we didn't do something about the number of poor people, that there we would have a similar population crash and famine and starvation. And so his suggestion was really about reforming the British poor laws. And his belief was that if we were too generous to poor people, it would just lead to them to overpopulate and starve.
Well, I'm surprised to hear you say he was a clergyman, because some of the things he says about poor people don't sound very clergy-like to our
Not
ears
very
today.
Christian.
Yeah,
yes.
He says, you know, instead of recommending cleanliness to the poor, we should encourage contrary habits in our towns. We should make streets narrower, crowd more people into the houses, court the return of plague, Malthus says. Of course, plague hits everyone, not just poor people. It's pretty ugly, some of the things he says.
Yeah, and you know, this is, I'd say, part of the problem of talking about population is that from the very beginning of this discourse, by bringing up this concern, you are associating yourself with lines of discourse that are extremely problematic. In this case, one that is basically explicitly calling for giving poor people the plague.
Our number here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today, The Exchange, we're looking at the very complicated history of how environmentalists talk about population. And this is the subject of a recent double episode of NHPR's Outside In. We're talking with host Sam Evans Brown. You can find a link to this show, to these two episodes, at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And let's get your questions and comments in right now. How do you hear environmental groups discussing or avoiding the issue of population growth and its impact on the planet? We'd love to hear from you, of course. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange. Or, as always, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Sam, is Malthus where this equation comes in that you talk about the episodes, sort of an equation looking at the number of people and the amount of resources they use, and just help us out with that?
Yeah, so not exactly. So it's his acolytes who came up with this. So if you follow sort of the neo-Malthusians, as they're called, there are quite a lot of them, but one in particular is a man named William Vogt, who many people call the sort of father of environmentalism in the United States. He wrote a book called The Road to Survival, which advocated for the use of eugenics as a way to curb population growth. But that was written in the mid-1900s and was kind of the more scholarly take on what would later be adapted into what was called The Population Bomb, which is a book written by Paul Ehrlich. And Paul Ehrlich was the one who wrote that equation. It's called the IPAT formula. Impact equals population times affluence times technology. So the idea is that it's not just population, but it's also the amount of consumption that you do and the type of consumption that you do that leads to impact on the environment. It's a very sort of quasi-scientific idea that is, if we're actually going to quantify our impact on the environment, it's a much harder formula to create. But as a sort of shorthand, it's one that has persisted. And actually, after we released our episode, we heard from professors who say that they still are teaching the IPAT formula in their ecology classes uncritically, which I actually think is rather problematic. However, that's you can sort of trace a direct line from Malthus through the people who read him and sort of expanded on his ideas through to Paul Ehrlich, who really brought the idea of overpopulation to the masses in the 60s and 70s.
With this book, The Population Bomb. I have to ask you, Sam, was this one of the tougher episodes that you've worked on? I got a sense from you yesterday that this was really difficult.
So much heartburn. I mean, it's just an incredibly fraught topic. There are people who feel continue to feel very strongly that we should be talking about population, who have not spent very much time thinking about the ways in which this subject has been wielded in problematic ways towards people who don't have much power in our society. But there are also people who have thought of those critiques, and as soon as you bring up the subject of population, will get angry at you for talking about it because they know about this problematic history. And so the way we tried to thread that needle is to delve more into the history of the discourse as opposed to trying to solve the population problem by looking at it as an issue.
Well, and you mentioned that formula, IPAT, that not only talks about the number of people but their particular impact. And we all know that here in the United States we consume a lot more stuff than people elsewhere. I want to play a little clip, Sam, of an environmental sociologist from the University of Michigan, Dorsetta Taylor. And she says population's impact on the planet isn't just about the number of people you might have in a family, but how those people use the Earth's resources. This is an important point, so let's hear.
If you have 8 cars, are you really contributing more to the global destruction of resources than a woman in the middle of Africa or Asia with 4 children who lives in maybe 1 or 2 rooms, who recycles everything, who grows her own food, who does rainwater catchment?
So there's Dorsetta Taylor talking about how people have discussed population, especially in terms of larger families that they might have in Africa or Asia. And this discussion of population, Sam, you discovered has a strong racial element to it, or at least it did, back in the day.
Well, I also think it continues to have the strong racial element. If you look at how international dollars are spent to address this issue, all of those dollars are targeted at places that have high population growth, which tend to be nations full of black and brown people. And the question of is that the most expedient way? So one of the ideas that we tried to sort of tease apart in this episode is it really that we're worried about people, or is it that we're concerned about the impact that those people have on the environment? And I tend to think it's actually the second thing that we're worried about. And if we're concerned about the impact that humans have on the environment, is it really our most effective course of action to be spending money to try to reduce family sizes in Africa through coercive means, which was done in the 60s and 70s? Or should we be more focused on changing our use of resources so that it requires, so that high standards of living require less environmental impact?
So back in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of focus on, look at those people elsewhere. They shouldn't have such big families. That's easier to point the finger across the ocean than to look at our own consumptive habits.
And try to mitigate the impacts of them. In fact, a lot of times you'll have these population groups that will discuss. They'll say, oh, we have to deal with population, 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 population. And then there'll be this little footnote that says, also, we should not consume consume so much ourselves. But it's always sort of lip service. There's no real action proposed. All of the proposals are still aimed at nations of other people where, you know, the hard work always has to be done elsewhere. And this was the critique that, you know, if we begin to look at where the backlash to the population question came from, it came from both the left and the right. So we have a historian who we spoke to, Derek Hoff, from Utah, who tells us that, you know, things began with Roe versus Wade, right? So on the right, there were places like the Vatican and evangelical Christians who were concerned about abortion and birth control, and so they saw these policies being used as a way to reduce population, and so that began a critique from the right. At the same time, a critique from the left began with places like the Black Panthers, for instance, who saw these policies again being aimed at people of color and called this neo-colonialism. And said really, maybe you should get your own house in order before heading elsewhere.
The eight cars that we just heard Josetta Taylor talk about.
Exactly. And so that began through sort of the 70s and the 80s. You know, Roe versus Wade was in the early 1970s, and of course the environmental justice movement got its start in the 1980s.
Yeah, a little bit later for sure. And let's hear Derek Hoff explain it. As you said, Sam, this backlash towards, you know, we got to control population. The planet's going to collapse if we don't. Hoff describes how this backlash developed against that prevailing narrative. Let's hear him explain it.
So as the conservative pro-life movement emerges, it wants nothing to do with folks on the left who are advocating for access to family planning and abortion, usually at the same time. And one of the arguments that abortion activists made in the early 1970s is that this would help bring the population down. And the pro-choice movement is uncomfortable with that today. You will never see it on their webpage. You can actually see a cryptic footnote about this if you read Roe v. Wade. But feminists did argue that this would help lower the population. But anyway, I hope this makes sense. The abortion battles, as they developed in the early 1970s and mid-1970s, completely ruined the bipartisan support for family planning. In addition, still on the cultural battlefront, it was really immigration, of course. And look at today's politics. It was the emergence of mass immigration in the 1970s that politicized population and sucked it into the culture wars.
So there we have the sort of bipartisan coalition that was in favor of environmental protection and looking at population, and then it starts to split because of these issues, as Derek Hoff talks about. Just going back a little bit, though, Sam, just remind us, earlier on, you know, late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of support for this idea.
Yeah, and I think you can look at, there was a population think tank founded by the Rockefellers that was founded in the 50s.
Wow.
And I think led to, that was one of the, their work was one of the things that led to Paul Ehrlich to write The Population Bomb. And Paul Ehrlich then went on the Johnny Carson's Tonight Show 20 times over the course of the 1970s, which I think,
which is
frankly,
huge.
Was unheard of
today. It's not easy to get those slots on the Johnny Carson
show. Can
we
imagine who else has shown
right.
up that many times on the Tonight Show? It was everywhere. So Paul Ehrlich, writer of The Population Bomb, founded a group called Zero Population Growth, which had a broad campaign to get families in the United States to have smaller families. There were people who would go out with the ZPG button on their shirt and say they're going to limit their family size to two, and all of these things were, you know, frankly, were everywhere. In fact, Richard Nixon, we have some sound from him making a lot of the arguments that again sound a little funny to our ears today.
Let's hear from Richard Nixon again, Republican president who established the EPA, by the way. Let's hear Richard Nixon talking about that.
If the present trends continue, it's going to mean that 115 million people, this increase in population, most of it's going to go to the cities. That's the trend. And our cities are going to be choked with people. They're going to be choked with traffic. They're going to be choked with crime. They're going to be choked with pollution.
Again, that's former President Richard Nixon reflecting the arguments made in the 70s concerning population growth and the environment. Today in The Exchange, we are unpacking a very complicated, fraught history of how environmentalists talk about population, overpopulation. Sam Evans Brown is helping us out, host of NHPR's Outside In. This population debate is the subject of two recent episodes on the show. We're going to find out a lot more after a short break, so stay with us.
Become an NHPR sustainer today for a chance to win a trip to the white sand beaches of Captiva Island, Florida. You'll also be entered to win our grand prize, a trip for two to Barcelona, Spain, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. Enjoy 6 days perusing the Museo Picasso or taking in a flamenco show at Los Torantos, Barcelona. You'll be automatically entered to win both trips when you sustain the news you trust and the programs you love right now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the complicated history of how environmentalists talk about population. That's the subject of a recent double episode of NHPR's Outside In, and we're talking with host Sam Evans Brown today. You can find a link to that show at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And let's get your questions and comments in right now. How do you hear environmental groups discussing or avoiding the issue of population growth and its impact on the planet? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Sam, Jordan sent us an email. Jordan says, overpopulation and by inherent extension, resource depletion and habitat fragmentation never stopped being a problem, and not for naught will worsen climate change, which 13 U.S. federal agencies just said is going to devastate us within this century. What has the U.S. and the world chosen to do? Jordan says, nothing. If it works against our comfy convenience or costs money, it's a, quote, fake problem. Jordan says, my vote each November is always putting the environment first to save us. I wish others cared more. He's right. This never stopped being a problem. What you're trying to explain in this episode is people really changed the way they talked about it because it did bring up some ugly things like eugenics and forced sterilizations and so forth.
Well, and in fact, the solutions proposed were often sort of blinkered ones that didn't really necessarily take in the sort of fulsome nature of the entire problem of human impact, but often just focused very narrowly on subsets of places that tended to have high population growth. Irrespective of the fact of if those places were the ones that were actually using most of the resource and causing most of the human impact. I think that there's a certain truth to that email in that these are not popular problems, and it's very difficult to get people to vote against their convenience, right? And so insofar as as it is true that it's difficult to form a coalition based on hating people, that's certainly something that the environmental movement has had to contend with throughout its history. And I think if we look at where the backlash against population specifically in environmentalism of the 1970s more generally came from, you see on the right that there were a lot of people who saw these environmental concerns as sort of a Trojan horse for what they believed to be sort of more sinister schemes of re-engineering our society as a whole. For instance, if a lot of the people who are concerned about human impact used to talk about something, and continue to in some sort of small circles, something called degrowth, that really what we need to be concerned about is human impact, human consumption, and therefore what we need to do is shrink the economy. And if you're a free market Republican and you hear that, that sounds like basically the worst thing imaginable. It sounds like we're talking about Stalinist Russia and, you know, pogroms and starvation. And so they saw these ideas of population as really just sort of the vehicle to achieve these other goals that leftists wanted. And it got wrapped up in sort of the Red Scare and communism. And it's funny because there was a recent New York Times Magazine piece called Losing Earth that was in the entire magazine was dedicated to sort of climate politics in the 1980s, and it talked extensively about John H. Sununu, our governor here in New Hampshire, and where his opposition to climate change came from. And he has a great deal of skepticism towards towards scientists because of these population scare tactics that were used by scientists like Paul Ehrlich. And he basically says that, you know, they say he basically felt that they say that they're scientists, but really what they wanted was sort of transformation of our economy for other goals, and therefore they're willing to say anything to advance those ideas.
That's very interesting to hear that the idea of looking at population and a rapidly growing population is possibly an environmental problem, that was tied to communism. Let's hear a little bit again from historian Derek Hoff on that. He says the debate really picked up steam after World War II.
As the world went through some of the most rapid population growth that it ever has, as birth rates were peaking, and as the Cold War made policymakers in the West very concerned about areas of poverty succumbing to the Stalinist temptation. And one of the main arguments was that excessive population growth, combined with improvements in public health, which means that populations were growing all the more, that those would become breeding grounds for communism.
Again, that's historian Derek Hoff. It just shows you how political this became, Sam, as you said. So you, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say it continues to be population continues to be sort of a mirror that reflects back whatever our fears about the world are today. And it's funny, one of the people who I interviewed and actually very little of that interview made it into the story was one of the directors of the current UN Population Fund, which spends money largely on women's health and women's empowerment programs all across the world, which is part of a shift that we'll get to a bit later. But one of the things that he told me is that there's begun to be an uptick of concern about population issues in Europe today, and that uptick in concern is coming from the fact that there are more migrants coming from you know, quote unquote third world countries into Europe, and so the sort of press of refugees and migrants into Europe once again has people in Europe concerned about population and considering spending more money on the UN Population Fund. And I think that just goes to show that a lot of times this issue just becomes a vessel for people's concerns about populations of other people in the world that they're scared of.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We are looking at this very complicated history of how environmental groups have talked about population growth, whether there is overpopulation. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your comments and questions. And Sam, let's go to Mary in Hanover. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I wonder if we would be having the environmental problems we have if we had less, maybe a billion less people. And I think that it's interesting. It's the elephant in the room, I think, and for the reasons that you're speaking of now, the population growth. And it isn't our business to be telling people who can have children. So that needs to go away. But I think if we just step back and think about nature's balance and balancing the human animal, the human being, with other animals that are all going extinct and our voracious appetite for growth, which is part of capitalism, I think. I think we should be celebrating, perhaps, or figuring out a way to deal with places like Japan that aren't growing, or, you know, their populations aren't growing, and be as creative about how to make those good economies and a good life for places that are decreasing in population. I think one of the reasons we keep growing is that we think, and we keep rapaciously using up the resources of the earth, is that we have no other model.
Thank you so much for the call. And boy, there's a lot in there, Sam. Japan, on the other hand, you know, I keep reading articles about how this incredibly elderly society, you know, people are lonely, people are living on their own. There's not enough young people to take jobs. I mean, that's the other side of it.
Right. And so the idea that if we were to just slow down our population growth, everything would sort of work out, I think is a little oversimplified. And again, the opening comment of that question, I think, really illustrates it. Would we be having these environmental problems if there were a billion less people? Well, the question is really, how are those that billion fewer people, how is that population living? Because, you know, so the Global Footprint Institute is this group that calculates something called Global Overshoot Day, which is basically at what point in the year have we used up a year's worth of the Earth's output? And they say that today we're using, you know, 1.7 Earth's worth of resources.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard about that.
It fits into this category mathy, quasi-scientific formulas, exactly, that I think are really problematic, and most of them are flawed in some important way. But if we are to adopt their frame for a moment and look at, say, how much an American consumes versus how much somebody from Burundi consumes, it's literally seven times fewer resources for one American versus one person from Burundi, right? So it's not that it's impossible for the quantity of people that we have on the planet today to have a smaller impact. It's just that we have not engineered our societies in such a way that they do. The question then becomes, what do we do given the problems that confront us? And what I think that I would argue based on the reporting that we've done in this series is that if your primary concern becomes what we really need to do is limit population and talk about population, you may wind up doing more harm to your cause than good by driving people away who are alienated by the discourses that population has been associated with throughout history.
Discourses meaning
Thomas Malthus trying to restrict.
Let's kill off all the poor people.
Let's kill off all the poor people. You know, William Vogt saying let's kill off all the not white people. Basically all the folks who have allied themselves with this issue in the past and honestly present, which we can get into, who have many of them explicit racial biases.
Here's an email from Christopher Sam, who says, are white liberal elites afraid to discuss this issue today because most of the growth is in Latin America and the Third World? And in these days of identity politics and hypersensitivity, they are concerned with being perceived as racist. Christopher, thank you so much. And boy, in the episode, you do talk a lot about this.
Yeah. So, are we concerned about people or are we concerned about the impact of people, right? Because the places where the growth is happening are not the places that are doing the most consumption.
And this is the theme that you keep coming back,
yes.
coming back to with all these formulas and so forth. And Christopher, I really appreciate the email. And I want to play a little bit from, again, one of your episodes, Sam, because it relates to something you just said. This is the idea that, you know, if environmental groups go around saying, you know, no one should have any children ever. And by the way, if half the people died early, that would be convenient for the planet. I mean, that's not a very happy, attractive message. So let's hear a little bit from Michelle Nyhaus. She's an environmental journalist, and she talks about how some environmental groups in the past, maybe now, have hurt themselves with the way they've talked about population.
The environmental movement, in order to have the effect that it wants to have, in order to attract, you know, the number of people that it needs to attract, in order for its ideas to prevail, you know, it has to be pro-environment, and it has to be pro-human. It can be anti-excessive human footprint, but it can't be anti-human.
Again, that's Michelle Nyhaus, environmental journalist, and she was speaking, Sam, in a part of episode 2 of this two-part series that you guys did that had to do with the Sierra Club. Now, mm-hmm. should we go there? Because this is a big part of the second episode, and we don't have to go into all the details, but it's kind of emblematic of how one venerable, well-known, big environmental organization kind of got caught in the crosshairs of this population debate.
Right. And I think, the thesis of these two episodes that we were making is that this population debate was really part of what shapes our environmental politics of today, right? And so we talked about how the right was alienated by some of these ideas of degrowth and transformation of our economy.
And abortion.
Right, and abortion. And we're sort of freaked out by the popularity of environmentalism in the 1970s. You know, as we said, Nixon created, oversaw the passage of most of our major environmental laws because he saw this as a winning issue. And so the right really launched an attack on environmentalism writ large, and slowly over the course of decades has been distancing itself more and more from sort of big green DC-based environmental groups. And in the meantime, the response from the left from environmental groups has been to ally itself closer and closer to the left, because that's where they're getting support. They're getting critique from both sides, but they're really only getting support from the left by the time you get to the 1990s. And so
that's interesting. It's a big shift over 20 years.
Exactly. The first environmentalists were the sort of bull moose Republicans. Teddy Roosevelt launched, the national parks, all that came from, conservative conservationists who were setting aside big chunks of land. But the history of environmentalism has been to move away from that toward the left as some of these chapters of its history have unfolded. And so through the 90s, you see these environmental groups starting to ally themselves more and more closely to the left. And you see this in the Sierra Club. In particular, there was a vote in 1996. The Sierra Club had in the past been concerned about population growth in the United States and had made a couple votes at the board level to say, hey, we should be studying population growth and its root causes, some of which might be immigration. But as they started to realize that immigrants were an important part of the coalition that was supporting them, leftists, they took a vote in 1996 to formally take no position on immigration. But unfortunately, there was this a large number of the supporters that were these sort of old guard environmentalists that still believed that population growth was a big issue. And so a counter campaign was launched to try to get the Sierra Club to formally weigh in on immigration because of this population growth question. And that was kicked off by a guy named Ben Zuckerman, who's a UCLA professor. And really what wound up happening is that this campaign attracted all sorts of ugly elements. So there's a gentleman named John Tanton who has a great deal of money and has laid the seed funding for a huge number of anti-immigration groups in the United States, things that you've probably heard of, Center for Immigration Studies. And John Tanton sort of mobilized his forces in favor of this Ben Zuckerman campaign to get the Sierra Club to weigh in on immigration. And it became very, very ugly very quickly.
Yeah, so the Sierra Club basically got caught in the middle of this whole thing. You mentioned Ben Zuckerman, and I want to play just a little bit from him, and then we should talk about this a little bit more, Sam. But here's Ben Zuckerman, and as you said, professor at UCLA, considers himself a strong environmentalist and kind of got caught up in this whole debate over population, family size limits, immigration, which all centered around a vote on who would be sitting on the Sierra Club board. Let's hear Ben Zuckerman.
Here's one of my basic philosophies of life, which I think applies in this case. One should not stop doing the right thing for the right reasons just because somebody else is doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. And if there are some racists or whatnot who are against immigration because they don't want more people of color coming into the United States, there's nothing at all I can do about that.
And you sort of hear the conflict there,
Well, certainly you hear that Ben Zuckerman sees it as unproblematic that he has adopted a line of argumentation that has been wielded in problematic ways. And I think the counterpoint is the one that we heard from Michelle Niehaus earlier, which is that if you are speaking in ways that alienate huge numbers of supporters, are you doing more good for your cause or are you doing more harm?
Well, and I was talking to last week a friend who works for an environmental organization and mentioned this population thing. He said, we don't touch it. We don't touch it because we've got donors who say, don't touch it. So that's another issue, is the financial end of this. Okay, so we've got lots more to talk about after a short break, and we'll keep taking your calls. So stay on the line. Our number 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, snow days. To cancel, to delay, or to open. How do schools make that important and sometimes controversial decision? We'll find out tomorrow on The Exchange. Send us an email before the show. This is a topic we think a lot of you will want to jump in on. So again, send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour, we're looking at how the environmental movement has changed in the way that it discusses population growth. We're picking up on the recent work of NHPR's Outside In with host Sam Evans-Brown. And of course, we want to hear from you on this topic as well. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is great, exchange@nhpr.org. So Sam, we've been walking through this very fraught history of how environmentalists handle the population issue. We talked about how it was bipartisan in the 60s and 70s, how these fissures developed in the 70s, 80s, 90s. It all kind of comes to a head at the United Nations. I want to play a clip from your episode, Sam. We're going to hear from Frances Kissling, longtime activist on abortion rights and social policy, and again, historian Derek Hoff, both talking about how the United Nations approached population and the environment by the 1990s. The whole discussion, they say, has changed.
The United Nations got the message that it was politically incorrect to talk about population. And a taboo set in. So if you look at, say, for example, the Sustainability Development Goals, there's almost no mention of population in the goals.
It's absolutely become a taboo. You can at best tiptoe around it in the most gentle terms. But you can never go so far as to say things like, we need to take steps to move toward population stabilization.
And again, that's Frances Kissling and Derek Hoff, both talking in a recent episode of NHPR's Outside In, looking at how environmentalists have discussed, or as we just heard, avoided discussing the issue of population growth. So what's been the impact of that taboo that emerged in the 1990s, Sam?
Well, it's funny to call it a taboo, I think, is both Derek and Frances both believe that. But there are some folks who I spoke to who believe that this is sort of more of a tactical move to shift the way the discourse is being conducted so that it's less alienating for those who are hearing it. So what happened is, you know, there was this pushback that was coming from the sort of the radical left calling population programs from the 1970s that included, you know, forced sterilizations of people and discussion of things like putting birth control in the water so that people could not have kids even though they didn't consent to that type of thing. So
yikes.
There's this pushback from the left to those types of actions. Also this pushback from the right that came from the Vatican and from the conservative right that was concerned about normalization of birth control and family planning. And that came to a head in the UN conference on the environment in Rio in 1992, where the environmental groups, you know, U.S. environmental groups showed up in force ready to talk about population, and they were protested often by their allies because of these concerns. And what that led to is these environmental groups basically said, this is such a hot topic. We're not getting much benefit from talking about it. And why don't we just give up on it? And then 2 years later, the UN met again in Cairo, 1994, where they decided they were going to come up. This was a conference that was entirely focused on population as a concern. And they said they started to grapple with some of these earlier problematic programs. And they said, what we really need to do is we need to shift the way that we're approaching this topic. And they adopted is something called a rights-based frame, which is to say there's going to be nothing done that's coercive. There's going to be nothing done that involves any of these prior problematic practices. Instead, what we're going to focus our efforts on is voluntary access to family planning in places that don't have that already. So encouraging countries that have taboos against contraceptives to hand contraceptives out. To give women access to those and to normalize their use in families, but also the empowerment of women, because there's this idea called demographic transition, which is that as countries enter the modern, you know, enter modern economies and women start to have jobs outside the house, the family sizes decline naturally. And so instead of these sort of coercive methods, why don't we just sort of encourage policies that empower women, let them take control of their own bodies, and so that we speed demographic transition along, so that because if we look at the birth rate in the United States today, it's like 1.8 people, is 1.8 children per family. So at this point, any population growth that you're seeing in the United States is really just replacement coming from immigrants coming from abroad, and without that, the population of the United States would be declining. And that's the case for a lot of the Western world, that really we've passed the point where we're below replacement in our fertility rates. So again, the UN adopts this rights-based frame, and the environmental groups follow in suit. And so,
more at women's empowerment, women's education, and so forth.
Exactly. And so, if you look at the websites of most environmental groups that are working on this stuff today, the Nature Conservancy, for instance, still has a very robust program around population, but they don't call it a population program. They say they're working on women's issues, and they're working on empowering women. They're working on giving them access to contraceptives. Because they have decided that is both from sort of a rhetorical standpoint, a way of talking about this issue that doesn't bring the backlash of the 1970s and 80s, but also achieves the goal that they've set out to accomplish, which is to speed these countries along towards demographic transition.
So, and women's empowerment is a lot more attractive a message than Thomas Malthus saying we should give poor people the plague and hope they die off.
Well, and beyond it being an attractive message, which I think is true, it's also one that is more considerate of the lives of the people who you're affecting. You're seeing them as people and not just sort of numbers on a spreadsheet.
Let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump into this conversation, Sam, so it's great. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. And in Center Harbor, Alice is on the line. Hi, Alice. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have advocated and been very concerned about population control for many years. I think the bottom line, the way I like to think about it, is that the earth can only absorb so much effluence and give off so much potable water. But I think that they were talking about Japan and China, and as opposed, China certainly is not the model to follow, but I think that education is the bottom line, because you just have to educate people. And you know, in many countries, you're fighting culture, you're fighting male ego, and for the producing all these children, and it's very challenging. But I think that it can be done. I think we just need to make the availability of family planning on every street corner for people.
That seems to be how Sam is found out, that that's how some of these environmental groups and the UN have approached this. But I'm glad you called, Alice, because we haven't really talked about China's one-child policy, and that was a big response to these concerns about population.
Indeed, it's quite an oversight to have not mentioned it. I'd say that it's probably the single most important policy decision that led to the backlash, right? So it
emerged in the 70s.
Exactly. Yeah. So the one-child policy, I don't have the date in front of me, but I think it was 1972 that they put it in place. I might have that horribly, horribly wrong, so if I do, someone should correct. But the right, in particular, saw this as incredibly problematic, right? So we're restricting choice, we're restricting the freedom of these people.
Well, and there were abortions of
millions of female babies.
That's pretty ugly.
Right, and exactly, and so the journalism around it really revealed this to be a perfect example of the type of coercive practice that the world community did not want to condone, and I think was crucial in the creation of this new framework that was eventually adopted in 1994.
Well, and our producer Christina Phillips just looked it up, so it was introduced in 1979.
Thank you, Christina.
After a decades-long two-child policy, and I think China just got rid of the one-child policy because they were having all these, you know, unintended societal effects. Too many young men, not enough young women, elderly parents not having enough support, all sorts of societal impacts that were not anticipated.
Yeah, well, and it sort of goes to so the caller that we just had from Center Harbor opened up by using the term population control, which is a term you'll never hear at the United Nations or any environmental groups use anymore. If they even use the word population, it's really in conjunction with these voluntary programs. And the one U.S. environmental group that I could find explicitly talking about this is something called the Center for Biological Diversity, which is they're largely an organization that uses the Endangered Species Act to protect endangered populations through lawsuits. But they also have a population program in which they give out endangered species condoms with sort of humorous slogans on them. And so even though they are talking about population, the idea that they would say population control, that type of language is long considered passé.
So, thanks, Christina, for looking this up on the fly. China removed the one-child policy just in 2015. I remember it was pretty recent. Now they have a two-child policy again, which to American ears still seems sort of weird. Like, how can you tell me how many kids to have? Speaking of having a lot of kids, though, here's an email from Bill in Concord who says, I am the 10th of 11 children born to my family. Dad always framed our family size in religious terms. It was God's will that he had so many kids and would answer questions about our family size with Bible quotes. Bill says, growing up in the 70s, I got lectured often by well-meaning people about the ills of large families and overpopulation. Those lectures died away, Bill says, in the 80s. He says, I've often thought that the argument died because it was seen as anti-religious. No politician or spokesperson wants to be seen as anti-God. Incidentally, Bill says, none of my siblings has had more than two children. While I love all my brothers and my sister, growing up in a large family was no fun at all. I guess that depends, right? I've heard from other people that it was really super fun.
Sounds like you could have a soccer team.
He says, yeah, right. So he says, you know, that's the impact. It is interesting, though, you know, if you look back, I think my grandmother was the youngest of 11 way back when. People did have large families, and they've gotten smaller and smaller over time. So I wonder what some of the people you interviewed, Sam, said about, you know, maybe we shouldn't worry so much about this. People are naturally having smaller families. More women are choosing not to have kids at all. So maybe that's why population has faded from the headlines.
Well, I think that if, you know, this is my opinion, but I think that the thing that causes issues to fade from the headlines is when people stop talking about them. And I think that environmental groups were so chastised that they ceased to talk about this. And that's, for me, that's why I believe it faded from the headlines. It didn't hurt that America was rapidly going through this process of demographic transition. And so now what you find if you Google population is you know, dozens, hundreds of articles talking about how the population bomb was diffused, how it's no longer a problem, how Malthus was wrong, how Paul Ehrlich was wrong. So certainly the discourse has shifted away from this is a problem that we need to worry about. And if you ask me why that is, I would say that the people who would likely consider it a problem were so chastised that they stopped talking about it. And the people who saw this as not a problem have continued to talk about it.
Well, and you can kind of understand environmental groups, if they're getting hit from the right and the left, they just thought, okay, maybe we should just shut up about this.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And also, you know, what's the interesting thing that I think you observe now is that because the sort of centrist environmental movement has moved away from talking about this, what's left are really fringy groups that continue to talk about it. And so and a lot of them are groups that have ties, some of them quite explicit ties to white supremacy. And so that makes it even more unlikely that environmental groups are going to want to take up this cause, because when you look to your sides and see who's holding this standard, this, you know, who's holding this flag with you, and you see people who are allied with white supremacists, it's really unlikely that you're going to want to pick up that flag with them.
Yeah, and that's the issue that Ben Zuckerman ran into in that whole Sierra Club
debacle. And he was unconcerned by it.
Well, and here's an email from Lewis who says, please speak to the fears that come with change and that many, many times are not realized. Lewis says, whether overpopulation will lead to starvation, which hasn't happened in the U.S., or the end of resources like peak oil, which we're still waiting to reach. Lewis says these false projections have not helped the movement. Lewis, thank you very much. He's right. I mean, I remember growing up in the 70s thinking, you know, maybe we'd all be dead by now. I mean, there does seem to be this hype, and then something happens.
Right. And so, you know, Thomas Malthus predicted famines that never appeared. Paul Ehrlich predicted famines within the course of 10 years, which never appeared. And the problem with going out onto a stage and making these stark predictions is that when they don't appear, you lose your credibility. And I, you know, spoke to this a little bit already, that John H. Sununu, because of the predictions made by Paul Ehrlich, proceeded to not believe climate scientists like James Hansen when he testified before Congress in 1988.
I've heard you alarmists before. I'm not listening.
Exactly. And I think that really the alarmism around population in the 1960s laid the foundation for incredulity from the right towards climate change that we see today.
Well, and they did not take into account the huge advances in farming technology and so forth.
Right. So this idea of carrying capacity is something that a lot of people will talk about. In fact, one of the groups that John Tanton, who funds all these anti-immigration organizations, founded, he founded something called the Carrying Capacity Network that talks about how population is going to lead to ecological crash. Carrying capacity is an idea borrowed from wildlife management, right? So there have been these observed, in fact, we saw this fall with the squirrel population, right? So we had a mast year, lots of food available, huge squirrel population responded, and then they were all smushed by our cars out in the road. So this is where the idea of carrying capacity comes from, is watching these boom and bust cycles amongst wildlife populations. But people are not wildlife, right? So we are much more adaptable. We respond to scarcity by seeking substitution, and so far that has warded off all of the most dire predictions that folks have made. In fact, I think that like, you know, if we were to project out into the future, I think it's very unlikely that we'll see any sort of famines in the years to come of those of the type that are predicted. Famine is actually usually a political problem as opposed to a resource problem. But rather, I think that what we'll see is continued adaptation and sort of muddling along as we have.
Well, and we need another half hour at least, Sam, because there's so much more in these episodes. So I'll just close out by asking you to tell listeners who haven't heard these episodes that you worked on with a lot of heartburn where they can check them out.
So anywhere that you download podcasts, be that Apple Podcasts, be that Google Play, or you can just go online to our website, outsideinradio.org. You can find them there. They came out in the month of October, so you can just scroll back through the back episodes. And while you're there, why not subscribe to the show?
So super simple. If folks aren't into the whole podcast thing, and some of our listeners aren't yet.
And it's free. Podcasts
are free.
And it's free.
That's the thing. People here subscribe. They think they have to pay. Just go to nhpr.org, look for Outside In, and you'll find it there.
Yes, indeed.
All right, Sam, thank you so much for helping us out. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.